Good evening and welcome to this extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for December 15th, 2023. On today's show, how the League of Women Voters is addressing climate change with resources. We'll hear from League of Women Voters Climate Interest Group co-chair Diz Swift and League of Women Voters of Idaho co-president Betsy McBride. Also coming up, irrigators sign on to salmon agreement, saying they don't think Congress will ever approve removing the four lower Snake River dams to save imperiled salmon runs, while Earth Justice, also a party to the lawsuit that prompted the negotiated agreement with the Biden administration and the tribes, says it charts a path towards dam breaching in 8 years. We'll also hear about upcoming negotiations of the flood control provisions of the Columbia River Treaty between the U.S. and Canada, and more book banning in Idaho's largest school district, that's West Ada. But first, world headlines from FSN and the Northern Rockies News Service.
From the Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Benji Hire. The Israeli military says it's mistakenly killed three hostages in Gaza who'd been abducted and detained there since Hamas's deadly assault months ago. The army misidentified them as a threat during its offensive into the Palestinian territory. Earlier, Jerusalem was targeted by rockets for the first time in weeks. On the ground for us in Israel, Trent Murray.
Well, this announcement will undoubtedly deal a devastating blow to families who have anxiously been waiting for their loved ones 70 days into this war, waiting for them to be rescued and returned. Instead, they will have received the news tonight from the IDF that their loved ones have been killed by the very army that was sent in to rescue them. We already know the government here is facing huge pressure from those families to get their loved ones home. In fact, Channel 12, a major Israeli broadcaster, is reporting tonight that hostage families are now considering a hunger strike in response to what they view as government inaction to get their loved ones home.
Two cargo ships in the Red Sea were struck by missiles fired by an Iranian-backed group in Yemen. Some major shipping companies are pausing all journeys through the strait after a spate of attacks on vessels. Lawmakers in the United States are continuing to hash out a funding package aimed at providing aid to Israel and Ukraine and reforming American immigration policy. But with a 3-week recess looming, the hopes of Congress reaching a deal by the end of the year remain in the balance. Even if the Senate passes the bill, the House of Representatives, the lower chamber in Congress, has already adjourned, and dozens of its members are still reluctant to approve the spending. Meanwhile, in Europe, Hungary's blocked a €50 billion or $55 billion EU aid package for Ukraine, just hours after an agreement was reached on starting membership talks for the war-torn nation to join the bloc. European Union leaders say Ukraine will not be left without support. Elsewhere, a judge on Friday ruled that Prince Harry was the victim of phone hacking by a British newspaper group. The Duke of Sussex was able to prove that 15 out of 30 three articles put forward in a privacy case were the result of unlawful information gathering. Julia Chapman reports from London.
The judge found that Mirror Group newspapers carried out extensive phone hacking, and he confirmed that the King's son was among the victims. The ruling also pointed to the use of private investigators by the publisher to find out personal information about Prince Harry and other celebrities. Mirror Group Newspapers says it apologizes for historical wrongdoings. During the course of this case, Harry became the first prominent member of the royal family to give evidence in court in over a century. He explained the impact that intrusive press coverage has had on his life and outlined examples of stories that he insisted could only have been obtained using illegal means. The judge awarded him $180,000 in damages.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
New federal legislation would classify discriminatory book bans as violations of federal civil rights law. The Books Save Lives Act would ensure public and school libraries maintain a diverse collection of authors and would direct government officials to report on the effects of book bans on underrepresented communities. Democratic Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley says as a child who endured sexual abuse, she credits author Maya Angelou's often banned I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings with saving her.
It was the first time in my life I knew I was not alone, and it helped me move forward. So when I say that books save lives, I mean that.
More than 3,000 books were banned last school year, a 33% increase from the previous year. Backers of these bans say only parents should be able to determine the kinds of reading material their kids can access. A new report from PEN America finds the majority of titles banned from public schools and libraries include some topics often considered difficult, including racism, violence, or LGBTQ+ relationships. PEN America's Laura Schroeder says as a former high school social studies teacher, she's concerned about copycat bans in which titles are removed from an entire school district because another district elsewhere removed them.
And I know firsthand how much students deserve access to stories that reflect their lived experiences, but also stories that are different from their own.
While PEN America can track the number of book bans, Schroeder says the larger impact on public schools and institutions is harder to quantify. Supporters of the Book Save Lives Act say it will also help protect librarians, whose careers and personal reputations have increasingly come under attack as efforts to ban books grow. The bill has just been filed and hasn't been assigned a number. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. West Ada School District officials have ordered the removal of 10 books from school district curricula and libraries after the District Administrative Review Committee evaluated 44 books on a list put forward by book banning advocates. West Ada School District Chief of Staff Nikki Shepherd said in a statement to the Idaho Press, "The decision to remove certain books from our library shelves is not made lightly. It is a deliberate choice aimed at fostering an environment that encourages diverse perspectives while ensuring the protection of our students. In the careful deliberation of our book review process, the decision to remove specific titles, particularly those with explicit and graphic content, is guided by thoughtful consideration. Our paramount concern extends beyond the pages as we prioritize the well-being and comfort of our diverse community. We are steadfast in ensuring that the materials available align with both age-appropriate and intellectual standards." Shepherd said the review committee, consisting of two principals, the district's curriculum director, and a secondary English teacher, invited several librarians to participate in the reviews, but they all declined. The Idaho Press reports the status of the remaining 34 books in the list is unclear, and it's not known if they will be considered for removal or stay on library shelves. Shepherd said the district is currently meticulously reviewing multiple titles. The 10 banned books are A Stolen Life by J.C. Dugard, Collected Poems 1947-1980 by Allen Ginsberg, Empire of Storms by Sarah J. Maas, Kingdom of Ash by Sarah J. Maas, Milk and Honey by Rupi Kaur, The Handmaid's Tale, the graphic novel by Margaret Atwood and adapted by Renee Nault, The Sun and Her Flowers by Rupi Kaur, Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen, Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West by Gregory Maguire, and You, a Novel by Caroline Kepnes. The Idaho Press reports the district did not initially make the review board's decision public, and the decisions were made in a closed meeting. West Ada is Idaho's largest school district. According to the West Ada Book Review Policy, the review committee's decisions are not made public unless the decision is challenged by the school board. Book banning advocates challenged a West Ada review committee's decision last month to keep a teen novel that indicts rape culture in schools in their libraries. The school board overturned the committee's decision, and the book The Nowhere Girls is now banned from West Ada School District libraries. West Ada Education Association President Zach Borman says members of the local teachers' union are frustrated about the recent trend of book banning and the parts of the process that led to it. Borman wrote in a statement, "No one knows where this will end and what our libraries will look like when we get there. I think we are fooling ourselves if we think that the forces that have put our district in the place of purging our shelves will be satisfied with these efforts. For better or for worse, schools seem to be the front line of the national culture war being fought, and currently libraries are in the crosshairs. Those opposed to book banning point out many of the bans are based on small sections of a book that are taken out of context of the entire story. Opponents also say the culture war book banning is taking aim at books that validate gay or transgender youth's existence or focus on hard truths about racial injustice in the history of the U.S. West Ada school district officials generated the list of books that they might ban from the website of a prominent Florida book banning organization, booklooks.org, that rates books on a scale of 0 to 5, whether in their view they are inappropriate for minors. They say books that rate 4 or 5 on their scale are inappropriate because they contain explicit sexual nudity, obscene references to sexual activities, or explicit references to aberrant sexual activities. The website implies that parents should be making decisions about what content their children read. It says, "We believe sunlight is the best disinfectant, and parents should have the information at their disposal to make informed decisions about the content their children consume." Borman says many Idaho school districts are taking preemptive action to ban books in case Idaho passes a bill similar to House Bill 314 next year. House Bill 314, which Republican Governor Brad Little vetoed, would create a bounty system in which a court could order libraries to pay parents $2,500 if their children see material deemed harmful. Borman said, "Anyone who wants to see important and challenging books like these stay in our schools had better be making some noise this legislative cycle, as they and the facilities that house them are not guaranteed. We can't protect them without the community's support." Lewis Clark State College and Idaho State University announced today they have teamed up for a new program to train physician assistants in northern Idaho. Idaho State University operates the sole physician's assistant program in the state. Under the program, a group of 15 students will get their training in Moscow, Coeur d'Alene, Sandpoint, Bonners Ferry, and Kooski. Currently, Idaho State University professors train physician assistant students in Pocatello, Meridian, and in the Treasure Valley. According to the Lewiston Tribune website, Idaho State University President Kevin Satterlee said the state has a severe shortage of physician assistants, and it has the lowest number of physician assistants per capita in the country. Satterlee said training mid-level practitioners such as physician's assistants and nurse practitioners has special importance because, quote, they actually deliver more direct primary care to patients than doctors do in this state. The Idaho Department of Labor reports physician assistant positions are the fourth most in-demand jobs in Idaho. The WAMI medical training program says when patients lack a regular primary care provider, they often develop complex health problems because they do not get diagnoses for easy-to-treat conditions early enough to prevent larger problems. President Satterlee said even though 15 students is not a large number, the program has the potential to grow. He said it will allow us to continue to expand our other sites. Lewis Clark State College President Cynthia Pemberton said the state is in a health care provider crisis, and the partnership with Idaho State University will be an effective way to address it. Pemberton said, as of today, it will be possible for students living in northern Idaho to pursue physician assistant graduate studies. This is a tremendous opportunity for students and a critically important step for our state. Pemberton said the colleges are discussing ways LCSC can expand its undergraduate programs, especially in physical and occupational therapy. She said both programs feed into graduate-level classes at Idaho State University. Pemberton said, It's not only a natural progression from our undergraduate through graduate education, but really the potential is from the two-year program all the way up to the graduate level, available in real time in location in this part of the state. The Idaho Legislature's Change in Employee Compensation Committee heard a report Tuesday saying while Idaho has lessened turnover rates among state employees, the state still lags behind other states in health care staff retention as well as in retention in other jobs. The State Department of Human Resources said in its report, IT, healthcare and engineering jobs have high vacancy rates in Idaho, and the vacancy rate for nurses is highest of all categories, with 44% vacancy. The Human Resources Department is recommending 4.5% merit-based raises for all permanent state positions and an additional 5.5% market-based increase for IT, engineering, and healthcare salaries. Benefits packages for state employees are generally better than in the private sector. However, Idaho is about 25% below market base salaries in both the private and public sectors. It would cost the state $41.3 million to implement the 4.5% merit-based pay increase for state employees. The 5.5% raises on top of that for IT, engineering, and healthcare positions would cost the state an additional $2.7 million. Last year, the Change in Employee Compensation Committee recommended 4% merit raises for all employees and 10% raises for public safety officers. The legislature voted to increase state employee pay by an average of $1.20 per hour to be distributed based on merit, and voted for 8.5% merit-based raises for law enforcement. The Idaho Press reports Human Resources Department Interim Administrator Janelle White told the committee lawmakers should be concerned about the state being way behind in salaries. White said, "This really impacts our ability to recruit employees and impacts our ability to retain employees. It impacts our ability to provide the services necessary to the citizens of Idaho." You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by the Moscow Food Co-op, specializing in food, goods, and programs that nourish and nurture our community. The Moscow Food Co-op is located at 121 East 5th Street. For more information, visit moscowfood.coop, call 882-8537, or find them on Facebook.
Irrigators that use Snake River water like the agreement the Biden administration has made with the Columbia Basin tribes, the state of Oregon, and environmental groups. The Lewiston Tribune reports the Columbia Snake River Irrigators Association has signed on to the proposed deal to put the 2020 lawsuit on hold for up to a decade. The deal, called the Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative, is likely to be finalized today. Irrigators Association Executive Director Daryl Olson told the paper, "In our view, it just takes dam breaching off the table for at least 5 to 10 years, if not more. It's just off the table, so why wouldn't we support it? It is very direct. The tribes, particularly the Nez Perce, said, we are going to trade dam breaching for new resource dollars." Nez Perce Tribe Chair Shannon Wheeler implied the tribe is taking the long view. Wheeler told the Tribune, "The Nez Perce Tribe is still 100% in support of breaching the four lower Snake River dams." The tribe's lawsuit was to maintain treaty-reserved fishing rights in the Columbia and Snake Rivers, and the tribes argue that includes reversing the steep decline in salmon runs that has occurred since the dams went in. The tribes which are party to the lawsuit are the most impacted by the loss of the traditional food staple. They are the Nez Perce, Yakima, Warm Springs, and Umatilla tribes. The Public Power Council, Northwest River Partners and the Northwest Public Power Association expressed strong opposition to the draft of the agreement that was leaked last month, saying the electricity development costs will be passed on to Bonneville Power Administration customers, such as public utility districts and electricity cooperatives. Daryl Olson of the Irrigators Association said the predictions of 5 to 50% electricity rate increases is overblown. He said he met with Bonneville Power Administration officials who have calculated an expected 2.7% increase in electricity rates. He also said the officials confirmed to him the Bonneville Power Administration will not be required to purchase power from the tribes under the agreement, although he predicts they will anyway. Olson also said the $100 million in annual Bonneville Power Administration fish restoration measures, quote, largely reflect existing commitments. He also said the agreement does not require the Bonneville Power Administration to upgrade its power lines any more than would already happen under ongoing updates. Despite the agreement setting the table for replacing Snake River Dam power, Olson does not think Congress will ever approve dam breaching. The environmental group Earth Justice, which is a party to the lawsuit, says the Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative sets out a path to breach the four lower Snake River dams. Earth Justice said on its website the agreement, quote, provides a comprehensive new roadmap for salmon recovery, including a call to replace the energy, transportation, irrigation, and recreation services provided by the lower Snake River dams so they can be breached. Earth Justice praised the planned $500 million federal investment in further habitat restoration, hatchery improvements, infrastructure improvements such as removing culverts, and improving fish passage facilities. The Earth Justice statement says the Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative, quote, explicitly calls for the services of the lower Snake River dams to be replaced and then the dams breached within two fish generations, approximately 8 years, to avoid extinction and begin rebuilding salmon populations to healthy and harvestable levels. The federal commitments do not include a decision to breach the dams, but do include a commitment to begin to replace their services and to work in partnership on next steps. The Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative and federal commitments signify a critical step forward toward honoring reserved federal tribal treaty obligations and recognizing the irreplaceable value salmon and other native fish hold for tribes. The part of the 1961 Columbia River Treaty between the U.S. and Canada called the Assured Annual Flood Control Provision is set to expire automatically on September 6, 2024, and Canada may want more control over their reservoirs in any extension the two countries negotiate. Leaders of both nations signed the treaty in 1961, mainly for flood control. When it went into effect in 1964, the U.S. gained significant control over the newly built Canadian dams and reservoirs on the river. The Columbia River Treaty contains the Canadian entitlement, in which the U.S. agreed to give Canada half the power the downstream dams generate, and most of that Canada sells back to the U.S. The two countries disagree on how much the Canadian entitlement is worth, which could be a sticking point in upcoming negotiations. Estimates range from $120 million to $335 million per year. Recent drought has brought criticism of the deal in Canada, with Canada concerned it does not have sufficient control over its reservoir levels. The reservoirs created at the time the treaty went into effect have also eliminated habitat and slowed the river to the point where imperiled salmon species have a hard time migrating. In addition to purchasing electricity under the Canadian entitlement, the U.S. pays Canada $65 million per year to compensate for Canada holding backwater in their reservoirs to prevent flooding downstream. This week, U.S. Senators Maria Cantwell of Washington, a Democrat, and James Risch of Idaho, a Republican, wrote to President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, arguing the U.S. is paying Canada too much. According to the Spokesman Review, the letter sent Wednesday says, "The current Canadian entitlement is not acceptable to us and to many other members of the U.S. Congress. Any compensation must be reasonable and defensible for funding to be approved by the U.S. Congress. Under current treaty provisions, the U.S. spills water over its dams without generating power to aid fish migration, but the U.S. pays Canada as if they were generating power." The Spokesman Review reports U.S. negotiators say the payments should be ended or reduced and that environmental responsibility should be shared between the nations. In a 2016 letter to Prime Minister Trudeau, Senator Cantwell wrote, "Given the growing impact to our climate, natural environment, and economy, I believe we must find a mutually beneficial path forward to modernize the treaty in a way that balances flood control, ecosystem-based function, and hydropower generation." This week, Senators Cantwell and Risch are calling for prioritizing negotiations as the expiration of the flood control provision fast approaches. The senators wrote to Biden and Trudeau, "The United States and Canada have long benefited from our close and extraordinarily positive relationship. We should avoid the uncertainty and potential disputes that could come from any further delays in concluding negotiations over modernization of the Columbia River Treaty." The University of Idaho has announced demolition of the off-campus house where four University of Idaho students were found stabbed to death last year will occur beginning 7 a.m. Thursday, December 28th. After accused quadruple murderer Brian Koberger waived his right to a speedy trial in September, the court gave FBI investigators and Koberger's defense team access to the house. The landlord transferred ownership of the house to the University of Idaho earlier this year, and the UI has been saying it plans to eventually demolish the house. The Daily News reports the FBI was in the house in October to obtain additional data. The defense team was in the house yesterday and was expected to have access today. A University of Idaho news release said the defense indicated they want to take photographs, measurements, and possibly gather drone footage of the house. Brian Koberger is in the Latah County Jail awaiting trial on four counts of murder in the case. The Second District Court has not set a new trial date. The original trial date was October 2nd, but Judge John Judge vacated that trial date after Koberger waived his right to a speedy trial. University of Idaho President C. Scott Green wrote in a statement, "The boarded-up house on King Road, quote, is the grim reminder of the heinous act that took place there. While we appreciate the emotional connection some family members of the victims may have to this house, it is time for its removal and to allow the collective healing of our community to continue." The University of Idaho says they have contracted with Germer Construction to demolish the home, and the firm will rehabilitate the site, do grading and other demolition work at a reduced cost. The Daily News reports King Road will be blocked to traffic during the several days the demolition is expected to take. The city says it will suspend on-street parking during the demolition.
KRFP thanks its listeners and supporters, including the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at PalouseFolk.org or on Facebook.
The Washington Initiative group called Let's Go Washington delivered petitions to the Secretary of State's office in Olympia yesterday to get a measure on the ballot that would make it easier for police to engage in high-speed chases. in the aftermath of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis in 2020, Washington lawmakers passed a bill preventing police from using chokeholds and no-knock warrants and from using tear gas in certain situations. The new laws also prevented police from pursuing vehicles unless officers had probable cause that a person in the vehicle committed a violent offense, a sex offense, a domestic violence-related offense, was driving under the influence, or trying to escape arrest. Majority Democrats in the legislature responded to criticism that the laws limited police too much this year by changing the standard for high-speed pursuits to reasonable suspicion instead of probable cause for the same offenses. Initiative 2113 would allow police to pursue with reasonable suspicion that any crime was committed by the occupant of the vehicle, not just the listed crimes. Supporters of the initiative which would go on the November 2024 ballot, say people are harmed when police don't engage in high-speed pursuits and that police are figuratively handcuffed by the restrictions. Amber Goldade, whose daughter was struck and killed by a man driving a stolen truck in Pierce County in 2022, said, quote, "Police were only able to watch as the man who would strike my daughter in a stolen truck sped away." Opponents say high-speed chases are dangerous and often unnecessary. Backers of the initiative turned in 410,518 signatures yesterday. Washington State Republican Party Chair Representative Jim Walsh of Aberdeen is the prime sponsor of the Police Chase Initiative and others. Supporters have turned in petitions for three Let's Go Washington initiatives for the 2024 general election ballot. Another initiative from the group would repeal the state's Climate Commitment Act, which creates a pollution credit market intended to incentivize major producers of greenhouse gases to switch to renewable energy. That's Initiative 2117. Supporters have also turned in petitions for Initiative 2081, which would codify a Parents' Bill of Rights law in Washington. Under Washington law, the legislature will have a chance to enact the initiatives as written, or if they ignore the initiative petitions or vote not to enact them during the legislative session, they will go on the November general election ballot. Shoshone County court records say there has been a plea deal with 38-year-old Majoron Kaler, who is charged with the execution-style killing of a family of four in Kellogg in June. According to the Spokesman Review, the criminal complaint said on June 18th, around 6 p.m., Kaler went outside his apartment to water plants in a shared backyard wearing a holstered gun. Kellogg police say video surveillance shows the altercation and the gunshots, which Kaler allegedly fired. Court records say Kaler is accused of shooting 65-year-old Kenneth Guardipe, his daughter 41-year-old Kina Guardipe, and her sons 18-year-old Kevin R. Smith and 16-year-old Aiken Smith. According to the agreement, Shoshone County prosecutors reduced the original four counts of first-degree murder and burglary to second-degree murder. Idaho statute says second-degree murder is punishable by 10 years to life in prison. Court records say Kaler told police at the time of his arrest he snapped after he saw Devin R. Smith expose himself to his children through a window. The plea agreement did not include a sentencing recommendation. Defense attorneys and prosecutors will take up arguments about Kaler's prison term at a sentencing hearing, which has not yet been scheduled. Eight members of the Guardipe family have signed on to the plea agreement, an indication that they approve of it. And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Groups in Oregon are fighting for consumer rights in the face of what they call a concerning request from PacifiCorp, the state's largest electricity provider. Earlier this year, PacifiCorp asked the Oregon Public Utility Commission to set limits on future lawsuit awards, restricting payments to actual damages for property and loss of life. This request, according to Jagjeet Nagra with the Oregon Consumer Justice Group, puts consumers' rights in jeopardy.
Because essentially what they're saying is that if you want electricity, you have to, you the consumer, have to take the risk, not just of us being negligent, as the jury found this, you know, earlier, but also for us being recklessly indifferent to causing harm to our customers.
Nagra says the company's request protects its investors. He argues that removing non-punitive damages relieves PacifiCorp of responsibility and denies consumers the ability to seek adequate remedies for their losses. He points out the filing came out after a Multnomah County jury found PacifiCorp liable for wildfires that occurred on Labor Day of 2020 and ordered them to pay nearly $72 million in damages to the victims. Mike Getz from the Oregon Citizens Utility Board shares the concern and says that allowing customers to pursue damages ensures utilities operate their systems safely. He explains that for his organization, one major concern lies in the legality of PacifiCorp's filing.
We feel that there are legal issues related to the filing and that it may not be either within the scope of the Oregon Commission's authority to grant a filing like this, and that such a broad and sweeping liability waiver may not be eventually enforceable by Oregon courts.
Another important aspect is the growing threat of wildfires due to climate change. Getz emphasizes the need for utilities to make responsible operational changes given the increasing risk associated with wildfires.
Utilities no doubt will have to invest in their system and make sure that they're operating it in a safe way to minimize their role in starting and spreading wildfires, and to also make sure that their system is resilient to wildfires that are caused not by their doing.
Overall, he says the issue comes down to fairness between large corporations like PacifiCorp and consumers who often lack alternatives. Oregon Consumer Justice and Oregon Citizens Utility Board both intend to intervene in the proceedings to protect customers' rights and amplify the voices of those impacted or potentially affected in the future. For Oregon News Service, I'm Shintia Hudson.
Researchers at the University of Montana have been awarded more than $12 million from the National Institute of Health to continue their work on a tuberculosis vaccine. It's the latest step toward developing the inoculation, which is especially important in the world's underdeveloped countries. This NIH grant to the University of Montana's Center for Translational Medicine will be used to advance a promising vaccine candidate from the pre-trial stage to clinical trials, the last step before it's approved for clinical use. Jay Evans, a researcher at the University of Montana and the chief scientific officer with Inimmune, says tuberculosis remains a potent killer in many parts of the world.
TB, now behind COVID, you know, was the world leading infectious disease killer worldwide. And the only one that surpassed that was COVID, and that was just for the last few years of the pandemic that we all just experienced.
All told, the NIH has awarded more than $25 million to the university and private researchers to develop a commercial TB vaccine, which, due to testing and clinical trials to ensure safety and effectiveness, could still be a decade away. Evans says ready access to antibiotics has made tuberculosis less of a problem in the United States, but in underdeveloped parts of the world it remains hard to manage, highly contagious, and often lethal.
In areas where TB is endemic and antibiotics aren't as broadly used or available for it, it's a huge problem. A lot of the people walking around who are carriers of TB, and when that progresses to pulmonary disease, oftentimes it's deadly, especially for those people that don't have access to antibiotics.
Evans says a vaccine will help get ahead of the antibiotic-resistant strains of TB that are now circulating. He and his fellow scientists have been pursuing a vaccine for 20 years. This is Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Hotchins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hotchins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hotchins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hotchins at 208-882-5536.
Shortly before the beginning of this century, a small group had a vision of a great human service.
If you received an envelope from KRFP, open it.
These dreamers were pioneers. They envisioned a great institution.
It's the end of the year fundraising letter. KRFP is here bringing you local news, national programs, and dozens of types of entertainment.
Today, I want to show you this world-famous institution.
90 shows per week, friends and community members on the air.
I deem it a privilege to be able to serve
public service.
Public service.
Public service.
Public service.
Broadcasting.
Locally curated. No algorithms.
Look for the KRFP fundraising letter at krfp.org.
As a dad, you probably taught your son how to hit a baseball. But have you taught him what not to hit? Teach him early that all violence against women is wrong. For tips, visit endabuse.org, brought to you by the Family Violence Prevention Fund, the Waite Institute for Violence Prevention, and Ad Council.
Even if you missed the in-person alternative giving market of the Palouse, you can still participate in alternative gift giving and support the more than 30 community nonprofits through the alternative giving market of the Palouse online through Saturday. KRFP is one of the many deserving local organizations that benefit from the alternative giving market. The website to check out the gift cards is agmpalouse.org. That's agmpalouse.org. You have until the end of Saturday to shop, so crank up your computer and go to agmpalouse.org for the alternative giving market of the Palouse.
This is Hell, and I'm the Bitter, Blind, Broke, Gap-Tooth radio show host Chuck Mertz, who tells you that right here on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, 90.3 FM, and KRFP.org at 11 a.m. each and every Sunday morning. This is Hell has been manufacturing dissent since 1996, bringing listeners like you the news that scares the news as an alternative to alternative radio, independent from independent media, and KRFP is one of only a few outlets around the world that supports our work. In today's political climate, that support is more important than ever to fight against the damage done by corporate-controlled right-wing media that has taken over the public's airwaves. In the past year, This Is Hell has talked about issues you will not hear on corporate or even public radio, like neoliberalism, feminism, sexism, racism, conservatism, cannibalism, and the meaning of infinity. If that's the kind of programming you want to hear, see you on Sunday morning.
And you're tuned into the Friday extended edition of the KRFP Evening Report. We now turn to our featured segment. On Wednesday, the Moscow League of Women Voters held a Zoom presentation with League of Women Voters U.S. Climate Interest Group co-chair and founder Diz Swift and Idaho League of Women Voters co-president Betsy McBride. We'll air the presentation now, which lasts about an hour. The first presenter was League of Women Voters U.S. Climate Interest Group co-chair and founder Diz Swift.
Welcoming today's speakers. Diz, we'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Nancy, and thank you for that nice welcome. Let's get this started. So, climate change in the League. This is from the League website. We think of the League, as you know, as making democracy work, but climate change has come to the fore increasingly as we have brought it to conventions, and work has blossomed throughout the League in all states. Some more than others, as you can imagine. And the statement, as citizens of the world, we must protect our planet from the physical, economic, and public health effects of climate change while also providing pathways to economic prosperity, which is, I think that's a lovely statement, and recognizes the challenge that we're up against in very many ways, including economic. So if my screen will go. So that we formed in 2020. That's correct. In 2020, the Climate Interest Group. And we have grown to over 1,600 members across most states. And what our job is to educate leagues of all sorts, ILOs, local leagues, state leagues, on climate issues, because we can provide the science-vetted information so that all the local leagues don't have to do that work. And we can speak with one voice, which is, as you know, an important, very important thing to keep our league reputation viable. We have lately with the National League come up with a whole host of information, and I'll show you more in a little bit, of things that we're doing concerning climate change. The one on the right here is the comments on NEPA. We were asked by the National League to give comments. We formed a small committee within the climate interest group, which we call the SIG, by the way, if I use that term, and came up with information for that that the league then published. We have recently been asked to form comments for information on a federal bill for concerning climate justice, and we are working on that. We'll meet first part of January. Those are due on January 19th. How you know about all those things, I will show you in a minute. In the climate interest group, we have 10 teams right now. As you can see by the little thumbnails, food, soils, and agriculture. I'll show you a bit about that. Water, which is strong in California, very strong in California, and strong in the Upper Mississippi River region, and in the Lake Michigan region, and in Chesapeake Bay. So we have a breadth in water with very different needs in different parts of the country. Renewable energy is sort of focused out of Denver, where we are the National Renewable Energy Lab, the national lab there, with talks from them. Climate action plans. What can you do locally to get a climate action plan in your region, your city, your town, your state, whatever? Two of your people on the pictures that you see, Betsy and Nancy, are both on the climate action plan team. Electrification, basically, we need to move away from fossil fuels. And for those who didn't see it today, there's new language from COP28 that says that we will be, I can't remember what the exact words were, but transitioning away from fossil fuels. And the big win on that is it's the first time they've used the word fossil fuels. Well, that means electrification. Electrifying everything, of course, means we need to have clean sources for electricity. Grids, how we connect all of the different kinds of renewable energy, how do we have consistent energy flow? All of those are really challenging. So electrification is an important area. Forests and wildfires, especially important in the West, including pretty much all of the, what I call the West, Montana south to New Mexico and everything west of that. We're working on that, and we have a professional Forest Service person as one of the co-chairs of that, which brings a really wonderful perspective, as well as a number of other perspectives. It's an interesting team with lots of discussion. Our health team is chaired by the founder of the Association for Nurses for a Healthy Environment here in San Francisco. She lives here in San Francisco. She's a professor of nursing. And we have a whole host of information, mostly from the Association of Nurses for a Healthy Environment, on our website for health. And as you know, we are in a health emergency, a public health emergency with regard to climate. Climate justice, as I mentioned, we are being asked to comment on climate justice in a federal request for information that's due this next month. Oceans. I will show you some of the stuff on oceans, but you think of oceans that would be important for the coast. It's actually important for everyone for the many reasons that oceans are super important in keeping the climate in check, as it were. And then so important, how do you communicate? And even more important in Idaho, where it's such a challenge. We also have a steering team, and both Betsy and Nancy are also on that. and a federal legislation team so that we are looking at comments for federal legislation, monitoring agencies, and so forth. We have recently been put on the league management site. This is what you see when you go to the league management site. And to get there, you can go to LWV management or go to the league front page and go to the bottom and click on management and then search climate change. And you'll find what you just saw before. And that has a link to the website that I am going to display for you now and walk through a little bit. So this is the Climate Interest Group website. As it says, we are your resource for climate action. We want everybody to be able to use the information that we have gathered together. It's science-based, it's vetted, you can use it, it's league-supported, and all of those good things. We have all of the imagery and so forth has been checked for copyright. So this is clean and available to you. What's new, I think, is a lot of people may not know about this, but what's new is shown here. Can you see this now? What's new? Yes, you can. Okay, good. So, oopsie, sorry, I goofed. I know it's hard to believe, but there you go.
Oh, thanks, Diz. That was terrific. I'll get Gary to turn his speaker off there. Okay. We had a couple of questions pop up in the chat while you were speaking, and let me take the first one. That's from Lauren, who wants to know, says, electrifying everything will require generation of electricity. How do we ensure that fossil fuels won't be burned to generate that electricity? Are the utility companies on board? And I'll just inject another point on electricity that came to my mind as well, and that is pertains to your expertise in mining and wondering about the battery manufacturing and the potential for reclamation and recycling. What are some of those implications with electrification of vehicles and others?
And you've pointed to a couple of pieces of electrification. The other huge one is the grid and reliability. And it doesn't matter if you use electricity, if you're burning fossil fuels to get it, as is implicit in the first question. The best way to make sure that everything is moving away from fossil fuels and towards zero carbon is to have a renewable portfolio standard. Many states have what's called an RPS, a renewable portfolio standard, that requires moving away from fossil fuels for generation of electricity. And the electric grid system is, as you may or may not know, incredibly complex, and the balancing of the grid so that places that are producing a lot we can balance to the places that need a lot. It's a mishmash of areas. So some places have a solid renewable portfolio standard, but they're drawing from more than their state. Most draw from more than their state, although there are some municipal producers as well. So the best way is a renewable portfolio standard, and by law, the power companies have to be on board. The other possibility is distributed energy, which I personally am a huge fan of, that you have microgrids and smaller. It's also, from a defense standpoint, much easier to protect. So the short answer is the electric grid and electrification is incredibly complicated. And so we in California have had many, many discussions on net metering and solar PV. And we have said that the league is not going to come up with a position on that because it's so complicated. We don't have the expertise to know it. So we continue with the balanced education. So this side and that side kind of deal. Mm-hmm. And as to batteries and mining, The full life cycle of any mitigation, so like EVs, you need to look at the full life cycle. So yeah, an EV driving on the freeway is using electricity. Zero emission, they all say. But there's steel made to, there's tires made, there's all of the electronics made for that vehicle that is emitting, that have emissions associated with them. And then you have to get rid of the battery. You have to get rid of the car. That's emissions. They drive on highways and that's emissions. And so the full life cycle of anything needs to really be looked at, not just one little part. And that's where I was talking about everything is interrelated, and what can be a benefit in one area is a drawback in another. So an EV, for example, great, but tire emissions or little particles from tires are one of the key pollutants in oceans. Benefit for one, drawback for another. So you always need to look at the whole picture.
Thank you, Diz. Kathy Dawes also has a question. She wants to know what really effective things or actions has the communications team developed? And along those lines, I wonder if you could also address the concept of public-facing information and then what's the domain of the League of Women Voters or even League of Women Voters Management. So what are these tiers of communication that we have and how can we utilize them most effectively?
So you asked two questions there, Nancy. Tell me the first one again.
Yeah. So Kathy said, what really effective things or actions has the communications team developed?
Well, I would, let's go to their website here. And look. So this is a communications page. And the most important thing here is inform yourself about this audience. So whoever you're talking to now, if you're talking to Republicans in a ranching area, you don't talk about, you frame it on freedom and economy and the need for their ability to make decisions and so on. You frame it for the audience. And so you can look at all of these things. But then down below, we have all of this these kind of things that are important to remember in communication. And then we have a whole series of resources, and there are so many resources in here that so climate change in the American mind, that we're talking about how different people see climate change differently and so forth. So does that answer your question, Kathy?
I guess what I'm looking for are some sample talks or presentations that
they're here.
Kathy, it looks like you're unmuted. Can you, did that answer your question?
Well, she said she's looking for talks, example talks. An example talk depends on the audience. So talking about, climate safe agriculture to a Republican area in Montana is a different talk than climate safe agriculture to Marin County in California. So when you say an example talk, it depends on the audience. So in that case, you could go to the Tiger teams and ask for help. And then the second part, you asked a second question, Nancy. What was it? I forgot.
Oh, that was just about the public-facing pages for the League of Women Voters. You gave the examples of the blog pages being available for public viewing. And then apparently they reference some of these other web pages that are particular to the topics. Are those referenced pages also accessible by the public? Perfect.
Yep.
Great.
Yep, absolutely. And we link to our League management stuff in the blogs.
Yes.
So, so that was suggested by Jessica Johns Caporel. If you don't know her, she's a staff person in DC that's just been a super supporter.
Excellent.
And she said, oh, well, let's link from the blog.
I like it. Diz, thank you so much for an excellent presentation. As people are mulling over your talk, they may have questions at the end if Betsy's time allotment allows to.
That was a Zoom presentation from League of Women Voters U.S. Climate Interest Group co-chair and founder Diz Swift. She was speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters on Wednesday. We'll continue with the presentation with the other presenter, who is Idaho League of Women Voters co-president Betsy McBride, in just a moment.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
We now continue with the Moscow League of Women Voters Zoom presentation from this Wednesday called Climate Change, League Actions, Resources, and What You Can Do. The next presenter will be Idaho League of Women Voters co-president Betsy McBride.
So in the interest of time, let's go on to Betsy's talk. I think you have some slides there too, Betsy. Oops, and looks like you're muted.
Thank you, Nancy and Diz, two people that inspire all of us. And as my voice comes and goes, I may be grabbing water. It's something that happens when you live in very dry Idaho and high mountain desert of Boise. Want to start with thinking about the State League and our existing position. We have a position related to energy, but it was very outdated. It was focused on maintaining this status quo. There was a lot of background information that was no longer current. So the state convention delegates voted to update that position with new emphasis on climate. So
Betsy, you're muted
so
again.
That wasn't me. I think it was maybe the boss. Okay. So the updated, the scope for the position update is to review the current energy position and then look at state policies and standards that would be required to respond to the climate emergency. So we do have a committee. Nancy's on it. Kathy's on it. And we haven't met for many, many months, but we're now reassembling. Kathy's going to have to give up the 19 other guys. Anyway, so we're reassembling, and we hope that you'd be happy to join us. Meanwhile, even though we have so there's supposed to be a pillow over that phone. There, even though we're updating that position, National League has position on climate. If you have go to the national management site and look on impact on issues, you will find The climate position on page 110. I'll hold my judgment about it, but the emphasis, I mean, it's 4 years old and there's more emphasis on stable climate and not so much on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which takes us to state policies. In Idaho, there are a few, and I mean a real few, of tax incentives for consumers. If you look on information related to your tax return or go on the state website, you will find that there are some tax incentives for consumers for a very limited number of energy technologies that seem to be more tilted towards rural users. Heat pumps is not on that list. And of course, we see a lot of interest in heat pumps these days, but you can't get a tax credit for a heat pump in Idaho. You'd have to move to California for that. There's also, and I don't think this is well known, there's a low interest loan for residences that exist in Idaho for energy improvements. You do have to connect your, you have to insure the loan by mortgaging your house to the state, but there is a low interest loan program. Now, the state legislature occasionally, very occasionally, weighs into climate issues, not necessarily to our advantage. excuse me. During the 2022 session, they took an aim, direct aim, at buildings and local government. For buildings, you may have heard this statistic, buildings account for nearly 40% of all global carbon dioxide emissions. So attacking building policy in Idaho was not a small matter. In the past, before the 2022 session and House Bill 660, there was an Idaho Building Code Board, and they met, reviewed the national standards, and decided on the new state energy conservation codes for Idaho. They were able to do that using administrative rulemaking, but the legislature decided that they could do a better job of being energy code experts. So they passed HB 660 and pretty much, as somebody said, kneecapped the board. The legislature took over the authority for deciding on code. They locked in an outdated code and significantly made it not possible for local governments, local, that is city or county, to adopt building codes, building energy codes, stricter than the state code. before House Bill 660, a state, a local government, as long as it was at least as stringent as the state code, could adopt more stringent codes. So a place like Ketchum or Boise, perhaps Moscow, but we'd have to ask Mayor Nancy about that, could do that. After the bill was passed, that was no longer possible. Meanwhile, the U.S. Environmental Policy, EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, reports that in Idaho, over the last decade, over the last century, the state overall has warmed from 1 to 2 degrees. So when you think of the implications of taking on something like buildings and their huge impact and rolling back requirements, then you can think about the effect on warming in Idaho. And when you think about the implications here in Idaho, we think about snowpack, and then we think about water. So that takes us to the 2023 session. There were organizations that were paying attention to this bill, but it wasn't widely discussed. It was House Bill 96. It was passed. It was signed. And it made an apparent small difference in the law related to what energy projects could have access to bonding authority. And of course, if you have expensive projects, being able to do public bonds is very significant for being able to go forward. In the past, the language of that law said provided for renewable energy projects. The change in language made by the bill, they took out renewable and changed it to clean. Now you can imagine how this enlarged who could gain access to bonding authority, and it was most specifically nuclear projects because they are considered clean but not necessarily renewable. Meanwhile, of course, you might have noticed a few weeks ago that NuScale, the developer working on modular nuclear plants, announced that it was no longer going to pursue the Idaho project. The cost had gone from $5.5 billion to $9.3 billion. And even with access, this is my comment, not their comment, even with access to bonding authority, they thought they couldn't come up with enough customers to for ongoing costs. Okay. The state office. The primary office working on our issues of climate is the Office of Energy and Mineral Resources. It's part of the governor's office. They are tasked with managing the federal grants from the bipartisan infrastructure law. They have a grant program for increasing the security of the grid system. Excuse me, grid system in Idaho. There's another grant program for cities and counties to promote energy efficiency and conservation with the overall goal to reduce energy costs. This same office, the Office of Energy and Mineral Resources, is the office that will run the rebate program that is coming in 2024. And that rebate program will support consumers interested in transitioning from use of natural gas to electrical. So it would cover, heating, cooling, stoves, water heaters, solar. So the rebate system will be quite robust. The state had to apply for the funds, but their website said they're coming. They also have in this office, and I'll check my time, which is, I see, getting short. Another alliance, which is was basically formed by Governor Otter to support the energy's commercial interests in Idaho. It's run by utility folks. That is, all the board representatives are utility folks, and there are no citizens on that board at this time, and that is local citizens. Okay, so I think I'm really close to my time. Nancy?
Well, do you want to mention the Dillon Rule, and then we can maybe have just a few minutes for questions and answers?
So the Dillon Rule is significant, particularly when you think about some of the information provided by DIS. The Dillon Rule is basically if you're a Dillon Rule state, local government does not have any authority except for the authority granted to it by the state legislature. So if the state legislature says you can't have strict building codes, too bad. If you lived in a home rule state, you could. But in Idaho, we live in Dillon Rule state. So what we can do and what we can't do is governed by that rule. There's an excellent article, a law journal article from the University of Idaho that you can find online with, the background and plenty of information. So, okay.
Thank you, Betsy.
You're listening to a Moscow League of Women Voters Zoom presentation from Wednesday called Climate Change, League Actions, Resources, and What You Can Do. The presenter here is Idaho League of Women Voters co-president Betsy McBride. We'll continue in a moment.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
We now bring you the conclusion of the Moscow League of Women Voters presentation on Zoom this past Wednesday called Climate Change, League Actions, Resources, and What You Can Do. The participants are League of Women Voters of Idaho co-president Betsy McBride and League of Women Voters U.S. Climate Interest Group co-chair and founder Diz Swift.
I don't see any questions here in the chat. Does anybody want have a hand to raise? Diz does? Okay, please, go ahead.
I just want to share that although you may not get a rebate or a tax incentive for heat pumps in Idaho, you can get them nationally. The Inflation Reduction Act, there's significant rebates and tax incentives for a variety of things, batteries, heat pumps, et cetera. So that is available to you.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my question for Betsy. She said that heat pumps weren't on that list for tax credits in Idaho, but I know some of the aspects of the Inflation Reduction Act are administered by the state, and Idaho has been notorious in its rejection of federal offerings is that in some cases. I wonder, is Idaho participating to the fullest extent, or do you know, on opportunities for states to benefit by administering federal funds for those purposes? Or maybe Diz knows too.
No, I don't know.
Well, it's exactly the right question, Nancy, because the rebate program, where consumers can almost have some of these appliances and solar panels, et cetera, fully paid for, the state had to apply for the funds. So there was a real question based on how the state has behaved in the past about whether they would do that. But their website indicates they will. The tax credits, and they're not deductions, the tax credits that Diz references are available on your 1040 tax return. So the state has no way to prevent you from gaining those.
Our eagle-eyed legislative watcher, Kathy Dawes, has a question for you, Betsy. Do you predict any possible legislation that might come up this next session that would relate to climate issues?
I think, Kathy, you already could answer this yourself, but I think the legislature is going to be so busy with vouchers and voting restrictions and doesn't really have much interest in climate unless they can figure out a way to pass money on to commercial interests. And they've already decided to tax EVs. So I don't think there will be.
I just call people's attention to the link that Diz provided for Inflation Reduction Act as it would pertain to Idaho. And that link is on the chat and will be included when it's posted to the league's website, the local league's website as well. We're kind of winding down here. I have a bunch of ideas mulling about in my head. You've both inspired me so much, and I'm sure you have our other participants today as well. Any concluding remarks here in our last minute or so?
Get involved. Educate. Advocate. Be part of the action. We need all of us to be involved. This is really important.
And that means working at the local level, working on one of the climate interest group teams, which is a good place to have fun and meet new people, and make consumer choices that will benefit everybody. And That includes transitioning to electrical. It includes watching the Public Utilities Commission. Yes.
And just one last thing. Educate voters.
Yes.
If we have a constituency that demands action, then you'll have representatives that demand action. The constituency will control. This is a democracy. It actually works. But we need to educate the voters.
Well, yes. That's the perfect concluding remark here. I think educate voters and vote. Those are important messages, take homes. And, certainly check out the kind of Climate 101 pages on our website that talk about consumer choice and what are the implications, how do they relate to climate change and climate action. Thank you both for participating today and for all of you for joining us. Till next time, see ya.
Recording stopped.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kylie.
Thanks. I'll get this sent to Sue right after this.
Okay, great. Good luck to you with finals week and everything.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks for your questions, Lauren.
Yeah, thanks for this, Nancy. That was really informative and useful.
Well, the thing that's most important to me to get the message out that the League of Women Voters does have information, a lot of information.
Right.
The challenge has been being able to access it. So hopefully this will allow more people to become aware of what's available, because a lot of smart, impassioned people put together a lot of great presentations that we can benefit from as a local league. And I shared with Kylie the how to do the programming as it might relate to climate change. So hopefully we can talk about that pretty soon. I mistakenly thought that Diz was promoting this for before the convention, and the deadline for submitting things prior to the convention is March. So, maybe we can have a conversation early in the new year.
I think an extra challenge for getting the word out is that we can get the word to other league members, but I think the broader challenge is get that information and those links to other citizens who aren't part of our network. I don't think we have enough voting power among league members to really move the needle, and we have to get it out to the broader general public.
Absolutely. So I'm glad that some of us have been nudging the National League to allow us to do that more. We have to be careful about advocacy, if we tread on toes. So that's why I was talking about the multiple levels of communication within the organization and the national, state, and local leagues and who can do or say what. But I think Diz's points and the fact that so many more pages have been made publicly accessible is to the advantage of our collective efforts.
Yeah, we just have to get people to know that information is there and how to access it. So talking to Lions clubs and other groups for our area, for any town where there are regular meetings of groups, for the university, the retirees, just groups like that, where people go around and talk about climate change and the availability of the information.
Indeed. Yeah. And I shared this with the City of Moscow's Climate Action Working Group at our meeting last night. And some of those people are affiliated with the University of Idaho in climate action on campus, too.
Yeah.
So there we go. And it looks like we have a KRFP affiliate on here, too. So you can count on KRFP to cover the news in depth that a lot of other news organizations maybe don't have the inclination or the staffing to be able to do. So bravo, KRFP. Okay. I'll talk to you soon, everybody.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Thanks, Mom.
Bye.
Thanks for organizing, Nancy.
You've been listening to a presentation by the Moscow League of Women Voters, which occurred this past Wednesday via Zoom. The participants were League of Women Voters U.S. Climate Interest Group co-chair and founder Diz Swift and Idaho League of Women Voters co-president Betsy McBride. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area, it will be partly cloudy tonight with a low of 30. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, high 38 with patchy fog between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. Partly cloudy Saturday night with some patchy fog, low 26. Sunny on Sunday, high 40. Currently 34. Want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP. Be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. You can also support KRFP by going to the Alternative Giving Market of the Palouse website, where 30 nonprofits in the Moscow Pullman area are presenting an alternative to gift giving with support for the local groups. That's agmpalouse.org. Also be on the lookout for the KRFP fundraising letter that may be arriving in your mailbox soon. It's also published on the front page of the KRFP website. Also on the KRFP website, there's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. There you can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. Also on the website, you can stream KRFP and listen to archives of all the shows broadcast on KRFP in the last 2 weeks. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.